May the words I say, may the thoughts we think, and may the deeds which come from them be pleasing and acceptable in your sight, O Lord our God. Amen. It's wonderful to see so many people here today, and of course others joining us online as we remember. But what is it that we remember? Who do we remember? Why do we remember? My brother is a military historian. His specialist area is the Normandy campaign. And he's just retired from 30 plus years teaching at Sandhurst. So if any of you officers were taught by him, my apologies. One of his tasks he has to now accomplish upon retirement is moving several rooms full of books and documents that he's accumulated over the years back home. As you might imagine, other members of the household are not quite so happy about this. And there is certainly conflict brewing there. In World War I, in the 4.5 months of the Battle of the Somme, around 420,000 British and Commonwealth soldiers died. And that's before you count the hundreds of thousands of French and Germans who died, and the many more who were wounded in one way or another. You couldn't even start to put their names in a single newspaper. And if you sought to read them out on the radio or the television, the bulletin would go on for days. The sheer overwhelming volume of suffering beggars belief. And we remember them. But what a waste. Of course, that was supposed to be the war to end all wars. But just 20 years later, and with many smaller conflicts in between, humanity was involved in another horrific conflict. And then the concept of total war. The first war had been primarily confined to the front lines of the opposing armies. But in that second war, anywhere could and would be the front line. The wholesale devastation from the air of towns and cities and their civilian populations. People in their homes and their workplaces, people at rest and at play, women and children joined the war dead en masse. And we remember them. And it's D-Day in June 1944 that I think serves well to remind us of the contradictions and the confusions that war inevitably involves. So I'd like to introduce you to a few figures who were present there that day, and each played their part, great or small. There was John Hayes of the 6th Airborne Division, involved in the glider assault on Pegasus Bridge. Ken Adam, an RAF fighter pilot operating ground support. Two commandos, George McFranklin, killed on D-Day, and Ian Harris, who fought on the River Orne and was awarded the military medal. They have all one thing in common. Perhaps an incident in the life of one of their number, William Howard, will give you a clue. He was in naval intelligence and was assigned to a cruiser for the D-Day invasion. The captain, suspicious of anybody strange on board, summoned him and asked Howard, "What do your duties consist of?" "Intercepting enemy radio transmissions in combat zones, sir." "So you're fluent in German?" "Aye, aye, sir." "Where did you learn the language?" "At school, sir." "And where was that?" "In Germany, sir." "But you're British." "No, sir." Those six names I read out earlier were all aliases that they operated under. Here were their real names. Wolfgang Waschmann, Airborne Division. Commandos Eugen Karagerstein and Hans Hejos, Military Medal. Klaus Adam, RAF. And Horst Adolf Hertzberg of Royal Naval Intelligence. And I could add to that list 10,000 times German and Austrian citizens who fought not just for this country, but both for and against their own. They were known collectively as His Majesty's Loyal Enemy Aliens. Well, like many of you, I was born well after that war ended. But the war still cast its long shadow over my early childhood. The primary school I attended was surrounded by military barracks of one shade or another. And the understanding then amongst us kids was very simple. We British were the good guys, Germans were the baddies. But as you can see, There are at least 10,000 reasons why my childlike understanding didn't work. So I have had to learn to remember with gratitude all those who died and fought, not just those citizens of these British Isles, but the Hertzbergs, the Cohens, the Goldbergs, the Patels, the Singhs, the Husseins and the Khans, and people of many nations. But not just the Christians, but the Jews, the Sikhs, the Hindus, the Muslims, people of many faiths and people of none. Who do we remember? They all fought to bring liberation to a subjugated people, and they did so at great cost. On D-Day itself, on the bloodiest landing beach, Omaha, 1,500 American troops were killed in just a few hours. And as we remember them, there's another group we have to remember too. Twice that number of French civilians died on D-Day as a result of our guns and bullets. Such is the appalling nature of war, so great its cost, that with perverse and tragic irony, bringing liberation to the people of France involved the deaths of very many of those we sought to liberate. Almost 20,000 French civilians died through Allied actions in the Battle of Normandy. No wonder the French say Normandy paid the price for the liberation of France. And we should also remember them. At times, war may be necessary. It might be the right thing to do to fight, but it is never good. So why do we remember? Well, for myself as a Christian, I'm used to remembering. Every week in churches like this, we remember the one person who died for us all. We remember Jesus not just to dwell on the past, not just in sorrow, though grief and sorrow are part of it, but more importantly, we remember that our response to the love God shows us in the death of Christ is that we might be reinvigorated for the future, for the tasks of changing our lives, our community, our world, by transforming it for the better. In our Bible reading, we heard the vision of God's ancient prophet Micah, when he gave us one of God's pictures of hope for the future, that we should learn the ways of God, and when we do, then maybe nations will turn weapons of war into simple agricultural tools. A picture, the tools of destruction being transformed to produce a life-giving abundance. A place where justice reigns for all people, where no one needs to learn the arts of war, where all will live in peace and no one will fear anyone else. The Christian understanding of peace is much more than the mere avoidance of war, more than the absence of conflict. It's about building relations between people, between communities, between nations, which positively and constructively creates a love and care for others, founded on justice for all. My Uncle Gordon found himself jumping out of an aircraft in the early hours of that D-Day morning. He said he wasn't worried so much about floating through the air on the end of a parachute as what happened at the end of the floating through the air bit. He said he drew great courage from seeing so many other parachutes around him, hundreds, possibly thousands, and how that courage ebbed away all so quickly. Once he had landed, mercifully uninjured, collapsed his parachute and realized he could not see a single other human being. As we remember the sacrifice of the many who died on D-Day and in the Battle of Normandy, those who suffered in so many other ways, let not the enduring tragedy of lost lives and the experiences and traumas of those who survived be in vain. For we, in our day, need to build relationships of peace and justice in our world, and we need to start where we are. It was in 1948, 3 years after he had ended his war in Germany, that my Uncle Gordon managed to afford to buy a car. And that year, and every year after, until he was too old to drive, he would go to Germany each year, and he would work with the local church in peace and reconciliation and in the establishment of a greater and deeper fellowship. That was his commitment to peace. And like him, if we wish to build a lasting and true peace, we will need God's help to change each and every one of us into people who have a passion for peace and justice and a care and love for everyone, to follow Christ's example, to love God and to love our neighbours as ourselves. Amen.